Welcome to Season 2 of my podcast, Friends, Relationships, Careers, and MTV. More of the best stuff on earth for you, me, us.
All right, I'm back with two very special guests, and we're here to talk about animals.
Special.
Yeah. Say hello, kids.
I don't know what animal that was. Well, but,
that was incredible.
That was amazing. Could have been a bird.
You guys are not actually involved in animals in any sort of professional capacity, but you are also animal experts, both of you.
Yes, that is true.
You've swam with animals. You know a lot about animals. You're fascinated by animals.
Mm-hmm.
And one of you guys are actually both reading books.
So are you.
Animals.
So are you. Aren't you as well?
I do have an expertise in animals.
I mean, that counts.
I think 20% of our friendship is probably revolves around animals in some way.
Yes, that's true.
At least, if not more. So we're here to talk about some of these animal books, and then we're going to talk about bird watching at the very end. But first of all, thank you. James, you picked up this book at the airport called Zubiquity.
Zubiquity. And the subtext is, what animals can teach us about health and the science of healing? About health and the science of healing. What animals? And it's by Barbara Natterson Horowitz. And she's a doctor. She's a cardiologist, I should say, at UCLA. And co-written by this woman named Catherine Bowers, who she mentions, like, you know, helped her with a lot of the research and a lot of the input, but Barbara wrote this book in the first person. So a lot of the sort of, I mean, it definitely reads like a...
What is it about?
Like a journal. It's about the idea that because of our, well, essentially because of our sort of DNA mapping and evolutionary similarity to, you know, the entire kind of animal kingdom, like, that precedes us, and how instead of looking at disease and all of these ailments that we experience as unique to us, that we should look at it in terms of a broader species like spectrum, consider animals as, you know, the same patients and the same subjects of research and all this stuff. And she's just found that there are, like, striking parallels along every branch. I mean, let me just,
like, for
just,
I mean,
read
for example,
really an excerpt.
We don't have time for that.
We don't have time for an excerpt. In 20 minutes, we can't read, like, a paragraph?
No.
I feel like I'm not doing this justice then. Well, anyway, I mean, it's sort of like, you know.
Have you ever heard of this, Ash? You've never heard of this book, right?
No, I have not.
I mean, it's not just like, you know, do animals get cancer? It's like, do animals get depressed? Do
they
get psychological?
Birds.
Do they get, you know, do they self-mutilate? Do they, what's going on, you know? Like, and they definitely get cancer. They definitely, I mean, all, like, basically they get every disease we get.
And not just the physical diseases, they get the mental problems.
Yeah, mental, physical, which are closely connected as sort of science is figuring out right now.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess my question is, how much do you believe in this?
Oh, you know me. I'm like a zealot. So, you know, I pick up a book. I'm like, praise God. Praise Zubiquity, you know. But,
well,
you're
only three chapters in.
Right. I'm only three. I mean,
why would people make this up? What is there to make up? What do we – people have been doing this research for so long. I think we really are learning some new things.
As in – oh, so you are sort of familiar with this idea that humans and animals should be sort of taken care of in a similar way.
Yeah.
Oh, because – You're like, I know when my pets are depressed.
Yeah, pets, but also it's actually my mom just sent me this news article from the Fredericksburg Times in Fredericksburg, Virginia, about a study about animal intellect and intelligence. So I can also refer to that, speaking on chimpanzees, bonobos, dolphins, and elephants. So it's more that this one's more of like their intelligence that I think we are all aware of, but I haven't gotten into like what this book that James is talking about, their emotions and all that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's based on, and it's tricky because she says that, I mean, the criticism stems from the fact that, you know, okay, so as human beings, we tend to anthropomorphize everything, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's like little dolls or just us, little thing. I mean, in animals are, of course, us, but they're lesser, and, you know, but I mean, it's like if you just look at the raw data, what heals an animal and what heals us, and you know, what animals like, you know, they become, they can also be addicts. They can also be fiends for, you know, whatever.
I mean,
nicotine. They can be gay. They can be straight. They can be bi. They can be the, and that's the prime, that's the crazy thing. The primary difference between bonobo culture and chimpanzee culture is the patriarchy.
Mm.
Bonobo society is totally matriarchal. Everybody has sex. It's but the females control everything, and they don't go around and murder other bonobos. But chimpanzees, on the other hand, like, totally patriarchal, and they go around in clans and they go at war, and it's like, you know, one of the animals, dolphins I think do too, right? Dolphins murder each other. It's like really complex shit going on. It's like, and so I think she, so in the book she talks about like how veterinarians basically, like the two fields of like human medicine and animal medicine, like, I think maybe even like as near as like 70 years ago, things were like okay. But then they like totally went on different paths where like human medicine got more funding and like people got, you know, so it's like it led to the mass belief that like, okay, animal doctors are a joke because they're just doing animal stuff. And it's like, you know, animal doctors don't get paid as much. They don't get, you know, so
like,
animals, you know, they're beasts of burden. We eat them. We look at them in zoos. We like have, I mean, so we've like, completely pets. Dominated. We're winning. Yeah, clearly, you know, evolutionarily speaking, we're winning. But I think she's just like pointing out the possibility that, well, wow, we can learn a lot from animals.
You're reading a book about dogs. Is that correct?
That is correct. With a lot of scientific background, he did a lot of scientific research. He's a man that he started a dog sanctuary with his wife, which is different than any rescue because they take the worst of the worst cases of dogs that will like 100% be put down. They're ugly. Wow. They're messed up. They're like extremely ill. They're missing limbs. They need tons of medication. They take those and save them and basically turn them around to eventually, maybe after a year or two, be given out to homes. But
wow.
It's like a free range sanctuary though. So they need a lot
That's
of
beautiful.
Land. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. That book is
just
called,
like, put them back in their natural environment and don't give them, you know, crazy, whatever, crazy.
What is the scientific research that he's doing on
these dogs?
He's doing
a ton about animal-human relationships and how dogs became human companions from wolves, how they turned from wolves to human companions. And it's so fascinating.
Wow.
And I wish I knew about this podcast before so I could write down some of this research.
Uh-huh. Well, thank you for coming on such short notice.
Yeah.
And this place is called the Rancho de Chihuahua.
Did you just make that up?
No, that's what I'm reading on the Amazon list. Like, I guess my question is, are they all Chihuahuas?
No, so they started out with all Chihuahuas. No, actually, okay. No. They started out with a ton of mix. They're all, like, super mutt dogs. And then ended up with a ton of Chihuahuas. And this guy was shocked at himself that he found himself surrounded by Chihuahuas and actually attached to these animals. So he goes all into that. Like, what possibly could have made him attached to Chihuahua dogs? And they also go into how we choose dogs, how dogs became pets, like the cute dogs, how they became cute. Because actually back to caveman era, they were the wolf pups were chosen because they were like the cutest, and we have this natural instinct like cute. I forgot what it's called, neophism or something.
Yeah, flatten the nose. I mean, it's like infantilizing. Yeah. Just to take everything and like make it smaller and babier and just make it like make it cute. Make it
right.
You can do that.
And so that cute factor has been around since like caveman time.
Wow.
Wouldn't they have wanted to pick big dogs to protect them?
Sure. And that's where we get the big dogs.
Oh, so it's like both. One's for pets, one's for like...
Yeah, well, they took the wolf pups and they turned out to be big dogs. The original dog was a wolf.
Do they talk at all about in terms of what this level of selective breeding and this many different like genetic directions / possibilities, but extremes really? Because, you know, you're taking like, I mean, that you know, talk about the ailments, some of the like, you know, how like boxers / you know, larger, bonier dogs are more prone to like, you know, osteoporosis and different kinds of like joints and bone. And
then the ones that have the short noses have all kinds of respiratory.
Can't breathe. Yeah, they can't breathe. It's like, fuck.
The bulldogs. But here's the thing. I'm feeling a lot of conflicted sort of issues with SeaWorld nowadays.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I am.
Because I have for a while.
So, like, what do we do to resolve that?
What do you mean, what do you do to resolve
that? I don't know, because they do put money into research and rehabilitation. They have the sea turtle rehab there. They have another rehab facility, the manatee rehab facility. What else do they? They have one other, like, rehab place. So, got to give them credit for that. But putting a giant orca in a tank just...
It's really sad.
Scares me. It does.
And the resale value, like, they're basically just basically shipped around the world for to make money for, like, random places that can't even support them.
Yep.
Right?
Right.
Yep.
And, I mean, the problem is I love SeaWorld so much. So what do we do about that? I mean, are you, like, would you get to the point where you're like, I'm not going to go to SeaWorld anymore?
Well, my cousin is. My cousin is very much like that. She won't go to zoos or SeaWorld. But I, like, that... The ability to interact with animals like that can't, it's like hard to stop me. But then I got to do it, you know, when you get to do it in the wild, like in the Galapagos, like I did.
Yes.
I sort of don't have that urge to be at SeaWorld anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. Wait, tell me about when you went swimming with the whale sharks or the real sharks. What did you go
swimming
with?
Sharks. I went swimming with the hammerheads and under, I mean, below in the Galapagos, you'll be diving, you'll be anywhere in the water with manta rays, eagle rays, sea turtles, sea lions, other sharks. You're like constantly surrounded by them.
And like you're not in a cage.
No. The hammerhead sharks, their mouths are too small to attack humans.
That's
they're not
to
interested.
Know.
All that. I mean, they actually, a few of them were intrigued. I turned around and one was sort of right there. In Galapagos, wow. When I was diving with the hammerheads. I don't have the urge to be at SeaWorld like I used to because I've been able to do these things in the wild.
Yeah, so, it kind of puts things into perspective. You're like, wait a second.
Yeah, because
I'm in their habitat.
SeaWorld is getting to interact with animals like that.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
If you can do it in the wild, I mean.
So does that sort of take away the appeal of SeaWorld for you?
Yeah, it does actually a lot. Like, cause I'm 2 hours away from it, and I still haven't been, and I normally. That would have been one of my first stops.
You know what takes away the appeal of aquariums for me? Like having like gone diving in, you know, like the sort of South China, the Philippines, like diving, like tropical. It's like all these fish that we see like just rampant in the aquarium trade, and you're down there, you're like, wow, this is how they live naturally. But then like we just want to like contain them,
have them,
and so that's . Puts it in perspective.
It does.
So, but I mean, the argument could be made that you would have had interest in doing these activities unless you had seen them in aquariums and SeaWorlds.
I think no. I think I've always had that interest. SeaWorld just satisfied them for those years that I didn't even know I would. I never knew I'd be able to go scuba diving in the Galapagos. That never even crossed my mind that I'd ever be able to do that in my life.
Mm. Oh, so SeaWorld was a substitute until you could get to the real thing.
Yeah.
A little bit. I think if for anyone that has an interest in it, it's like if you get to see it up close and real. I mean, it's like, wow, what an opportunity. And I think like they, you know, by posting all of this research and all of this, I mean, it's like sort of saying like, okay, we're a company, but we're carbon neutral because we do good things. And it's like, wait a second. Okay, you're doing both. So, you know, it's like going to the zoo, going to the SeaWorld. It's just kind of like it's like a mixed bag of emotions. Like you're going to get it all, you know?
Yeah. Agreed. So while I was in Thailand, I'm planning my trip to Thailand. Everybody's, you know, I'm looking at all these things to do with the elephants. And then there are some people that are like, don't do it. Don't support that. They're very much abused. And that was another perfect example. Like I could not resist it. I could not give up a chance to interact with elephants like that. And it was some of the stuff I saw was disturbing, but I also got to have like a Jane Goodall connection with these animals. I will never forget. I'll never forget like that feeling. I was sat with the elephants for like 16 hours the entire day, the night. And then the guys that worked there were watching me. And the next morning they let me go in there. I'm sure you've seen those pictures that they let me go in there and wash them in their little pond. And just, but they're not supposed to let people do that. And then they tell me like to get on their head, and he just like took me for a walk, and I was not like sitting on his head, not strapped in. They don't like never do that for tourists.
Crazy.
They just saw like how into it I was, but they are not. I mean, they live pretty decent life. They have a lot of area to roam, but the trainers are not their friend. The trainers are definitely...
Well, they're beasts of burden, you know?
I mean, do they treat them worse than they would treat a pet? Yes.
Oh, yeah. They are not their pets.
Yeah. And so did you feel sad looking at these elephants? You're like, man, I wish they had a different life.
Oh, yeah. I swore I was not going to... I still, like, in my head think I'm going to go back there and adopt an elephant and retire in Thailand. That idea, like, has passed through my head multiple times. Because, though, I didn't know this at the time, they have all kinds of elephant rehab and rescues there. And I saw this truck go by with, like, the advertisement on that for the rehab facility. And I was like, oh, my God, I should have put my money into that. And then I felt really guilty. And you do feel guilty, but they will
feel,
tell you. They're like, these are the lucky ones, because the ones that are used for labor, they still use elephants for labor there. And they are severely abused. And we were hiking through the woods, and we came across one. It was living literally out in the woods, chained up to a tree, and it was, like, emaciated. And I'm powerless. I feel powerless. How can I just take this elephant and rescue it? I couldn't.
Like, they use them to, like, plow?
Yep. Yep.
Wow. They're beasts of burden for like, not only petting zoos and rides, but for, like, animals that just labor and just, like, I mean, essentially, it's what we're doing to the tuna. It's what we're doing to the fish.
Well, with an elephant with, like, a piece of labor, I mean, you know, in a way, but
laboring.
Don't you want to preserve its health? Because this is, like, your main mode of doing stuff.
Yeah. You want to preserve its health, but to, like, what capacity? I mean, it's like, what is it in the interest of the animal that it's actually doing this much labor for you, and you're making X amount of, you know, profit margin off of what it's off of its horsepower or elephant power or what have you. No, yeah. The animal's getting completely jacked.
Right, and it needs to be completely dominated and controlled. They don't want to ever have to worry about this giant animal putting them in danger. And so they use any means necessary to control it, and it was just disturbing to watch. Because I also have read lots of studies about how working with an animal and treating it with kindness as you would do to another human also gets the same results.
It gets the same results.
Yeah. Oh God, what book was that I was reading?
You read a lot of books about animals.
I know. Oh, most of my books, they're either about Africa or animals.
Right. They're either genocide or animals.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you guys for coming.
Thank you for having us. Thank you for having such animal experts on your show.
It's been lovely.
No problem. I'll bring you guys again for more animal-related talk.
Next time, it's the animal game. Animal alphabet.
Yeah.